Hi everyone, Scott here. There was some pretty big Formula One news came out this week that Christian Horner has been relieved of his duties as team principal at Red Bull Racing. And unfortunately, we recorded this podcast the night before this happened. So although we do touch on Red Bull a little bit in this podcast, we had no idea this was going to happen. And neither did anybody else by the sounds of it. Anyway, we're going to do a slightly longer episode on that next week. But in the meantime, have a listen to our British Grand Prix podcast. Thanks.
How much of a Porsche Cayman is in your kitchen right now?
I mean, there's bees and a soldering iron.
that's significantly more.
Couple of lights.
I have no idea what those bits actually are or what they actually do. Or it's even like those, how much they actually cost.
I have three of these. I started with two, and then I had one, and then I had to get two more. The annoying thing is actually the paint match on the new set's not quite as good as the old ones, but one of them is in a hedge somewhere between here and Romsey, and I have no idea where. more specifically, between here and the first service station on the M5.
It's like those magazines where you get a bit of a car model if you keep subscribing every...
Yeah, there's a stone chip repair kit down there as well.
You have much more Porsche in your kitchen than the average person, I'll say that.
Most of my tools.
Do you think that's, you know, that kind of get car parts through subscription? That's the Haas F1 model, isn't it? You know, they just subscribe to Ferrari. And Ferrari just send them bits every few months. Here is a new gearbox. Here is a new floor.
It's some of the old stuff that they don't want anymore. Do they get all the pre-Silverstone upgrade stuff?
Well, they need to do something.
I don't think throwing new car parts at the Haas will do much when they spend most of the time driving into each other and other teams and other cars. It was a pretty terrible race for them.
I'm just going to put it out there. That was the most glorious double spin I have ever seen in 30 years of watching Formula One. It was incredible.
It's the kind of thing that Formula Drift kind of aspired to, wasn't it? That sort of tandem slide, perfectly in unison.
Yeah, I mean, the angles were perfect. The spin was perfect. I think you would be hard-pressed to do that on purpose. I don't think you could get two drivers. I think even Ken Block, and I know he's dead, but like, I know that you could not get Ken Block and a clone of Ken Block to do that.
Okay, you're running out of rally drivers here.
Well, I was just trying to think of precision driver, and you know, Ken Block is your classic precision driver, and what's better than two Ken Blocks?
It's like it wouldn't have been any more perfect unless it was Formula Drift competitor number one and Formula Drift competitor number two.
I think you'll find that you can watch that live in the racing line now.
I'm not sure I want to. I mean, it's only going to be a disappointment compared to Esteban Ocon and Ollie Bearman. It's just not going to be as good. Those guys should be points for style.
Quite surprised that the... they came back as no further action on either driver on that one.
Teammates hit teammates. You don't want to drag it out anymore, do you, really?
Yeah, but Bearman was fully alongside and Ocon just decided, well, I want to be over there where the other car is. So turned into him. It was a little bit poor.
Yeah, don't you think Esteban Ocon's been penalised enough? by having to be himself every day.
I mean, as a Max Verstappen fan, no, I don't think he has been penalised enough. I'm still bitter about Brazil, what was it, 2019?
How did you feel as a Max Verstappen fan about the British Grand Prix of 2025?
Well, it happened.
It kept happening as well.
It happened.
Particularly kept happening in a slide out of Stowe as well. It just kept on going.
That kept sliding. Okay, speaking as the representative Max fan, it was okay. I mean, I didn't really Yeah, Max did a Max and lost his head. And Spawn coming out of Stowe.
Nah, ain't as harsh. I think his race averages out to okay, because he had a dreadful race. But he also had an appalling car with a Monza spec rear wing on it, because they gambled on a dry race. Given the circumstances, I think he did all right.
I think the pole lap was the best bit about his weekend, by far. And then going home.
It's quite funny because the pole lap was good, and then you watch everybody else's qualifying laps and you realise that Max's lap wasn't actually that great. It's just everybody else cocked up. Every single one of them.
It was just the eye of the storm in a
hurricane
of quite poor laps.
Yeah. I mean, well done for pulling it off, though.
Yeah.
It's not the first time this year we've said that either.
No, I mean, he can drag a good qualifying result out of that car when needs be. But there's no way he's going to drag a good, you know, a similar amount of race wins out of that. It would have been interesting. Right, here's a question for each of you. Obviously, Max set his pole lap on super low downforce, high top speed, blah, 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 blah. We all know how car setups work. Imagine if Sunday had been dry. What do you think would have happened?
Would have been third.
Behind the two McLarens?
Yeah, everybody would be behind. The gap was just too massive.
With
probably
considerable
its tires
speed advantage down the straight to overtake.
It got him in the pit stops. The McLaren didn't have the straight line speed to make the pass, but it had the overall lap time to achieve it. And you just need to be there with DRS doing the pit stops. I think McLaren's advantage was kind of ludicrous, really. In an incredibly impressive way that we haven't seen since, Max Verstappen a year or so ago. So I think he'd have been third, to be honest, which would have been incredibly impressive given what they had to do to get some performance out of that car.
That car is not good. I know that's like very obvious, and it's very obvious to us. And it's very obvious to Max Verstappen. Do you think anybody has told Red Bull that their car isn't very good?
You know, like in the 90s where we always wanted to put Michael Schumacher in a Minardi or something. Is that really kind of what we're actually seeing here? Because it's kind of seventh or eighth best car on the grid, really. So you've got to look at Tsunoda and see where the car really is. You know, that's kind of the performance of that car, really, because there's nothing wrong with Yuki Tsunoda. Ragged on him a little bit over the years, but he's a perfectly average Formula One driver, really. And that's intended as something of a compliment, I suppose, but maybe it isn't. But, you know, you get the performance out of the car. You remember, like, Nico Rosberg was most of the time kind of an AI driver? You put him in and you got the speed of the car that you were going to get until he really stepped it up against Lewis in 2016. It's a bit like that. Like Max just outperforms that car. He drives around it like a broken iRacing car. Somehow it kind of works most of the time for Max Verstappen. It has not worked for anyone else since Daniel Ricciardo packed it in. And well, did it really work for Daniel Ricciardo? Daniel Ricciardo didn't know what he was doing. It just kind of worked out. Two wrongs equal to right in that one, I think, really. But yeah, it's just not a good car. They've lost a lot of good people. Car hasn't got any better. It's not going to get any better, surely.
What do you think is going to happen for 2026? Do you think they're going to turn this car around for 2026?
It's a different rule set, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's why I'm asking.
I don't think so, to be honest. I don't see that recovering. I think you asked before, do you see the start of the McLaren era? And I said no, because the rules are changing. But I somehow don't see Red Bull coming out as the top of the next rule set, given how badly they're struggling at the moment. Because I don't think it's just a rule set problem for them, because we've been through this with them and they were winning before. It's a brain drain problem that they've got.
Yeah, it feels like the only thing that would save Red Bull for next year is if somehow the new powertrain is just the class of the field, which it might well be. We don't know that it won't be, but it would be a bit of a Hail Mary if it is. You'd expect them to be weaker on the aero side than they have been in the past. I don't think that's unkind to say. because they've been weaker ever since they sort of froze Adrian Newey out a little bit. However long ago that actually was now. Over a year at this point.
I watched Ted's notebook on YouTube after the race, and he said at some point they're going to have to start questioning Yuki Tsunoda. And I'm like, okay, so who's next in line then to do the exact same thing as everybody else then? We're in an Alpine situation that they've got as well, where they're now going, oh, Colapinto, turns out he's not that great. Called it, by the way, just saying that. We absolutely called that one. So what do you do with, what do you do next year? It's like the car might not be any good. Max might have an exit clause. Yuki is in no way set in that seat. This could be a completely different team next year.
Yuki Tsunoda team leader.
Valtteri Bottas to Red Bull.
Put Lindblom straight into the car rather than into the Toro Rosso.
Yeah, they'll swap Hadja and Tsunoda and then put Lindblom in it and then kill two more careers probably. Somehow Lawson will still be there in the RB being bang average at best.
That's generous after this weekend.
I don't know. But it just feels like Red Bull are lost from, particularly from an aerodynamic point of view, but it's that same old driver development program, driver program argument. It's like, what are they actually doing?
I think they've said that the tools at the factory just aren't up to scratch. You know, and I think in particular they're referring to the wind tunnel. And aren't they bringing a new wind tunnel online at some point? I think they're working on one. And possibly the sim as well.
What's the line Christian Horner keeps liking? It's like it's a Cold War relic or something, that wind tunnel.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Something to it, and there's certainly something to it with the simulators, but tools are still just tools. Adrian Newey famously just draws stuff on paper with a slide rule, you know.
He also is one.
Well, yeah.
So is Christian, just in a different way.
But Adrian Newey is a weapon. Christian Horner is a tool. It's a different thing. Yeah, I don't know. They've got a lot of people. Sometimes it can only take the right two or three at the top to make the difference. We've seen that in McLaren. You know, they fundamentally still got the same people that they've had for years. The major changes have been in the leadership and galvanizing people underneath you, getting the best out of your people. I think we've probably all seen it in various lines of work where individuals can be quite talented, but with the wrong leadership, you might not be getting the best out of them. It's not necessarily down to the individuals. It is about the leadership. And Red Bull have lost that in spades over the last year or two. I don't know how they come back from it, really, because they still seem to be in some kind of denial that it's always the second driver's fault. Because they've got Max Verstappen as the ultimate barometer of performance, I suppose. But you've got to look past it. So they had flashes of it when the car suited Perez. Didn't quite suit Max Verstappen's pointiness so well. But all of a sudden you had Perez competing for wins and in second place, a close second to Max until the car went away. It's like that should be a data point. It's like you can have a car that is very good, very neutral, that two drivers can drive. That's the McLaren right now. But there's no reason why Red Bull can't build that. It's just, it does seem like they're in some kind of massive amount of denial. I don't know how else to put it, really.
I think it's fair to say that we're entering a period of Red Bull. What's the opposite of dominance? Because I don't want to say failure. I don't think failure is the right word here. But it's no longer the McLaren era. Sorry, it's no longer the Red Bull era. But I'm kind of intrigued as to what's going to happen with Aston Martin longer term.
They'll just keep going until Lawrence gets bored and then sell it to either someone in India again, because it's probably been in their hands at some point, or somebody in the Middle East. And that'll be it. Maybe he'll work it out when it turns out Lance is not going to be a world champion. And then they ship him off to Le Mans, does that a couple of times, realizes that he's not really into that either. And then that's it. Then the brand gets sold.
Yeah, and Lance Stroll finally gets to play tennis.
You do get the impression with Lance that he's really not into this career, is he? He's just doing it. You see the video of him on the driver's parade where he's just sitting down on a chair chatting away to somebody else. He's not interested in the crowd whatsoever. He clearly does not want to be there. It feels like Lawrence Stroll living out his fantasy through Lance a little bit of trying to get a world championship.
Right, pop quiz.
Is his team being sold?
Lawrence Stroll has a lot of money, but what did he do to make that money? Do you, any of you know?
No, actually, I don't know.
Miscellaneous business.
Would you like to know?
Probably exploited some kind of group of people. I don't know.
I mean, the reason I ask is I also don't know.
Scott's quizzes, man.
Oh, yeah. Let's just say like oil and property and stuff and things.
Does that mean we're doing that great podcasting thing of Googling during a podcast, which is always great content?
I think I read it once and it just wasn't interesting enough to remember. It's like you just made money, like business.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't like, oh, he invented diamonds or something.
Stroll's father brought Pierre Cardin fashion wear and Ralph Lauren clothing to Europe.
He introduced Tommy Hilfiger as a sponsor and stuff like that, wasn't it? Something like that.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So what did he do to make his money? He was born into it, is what we're saying.
What did he do to make his money? He had money.
Yeah.
Well, that's how you get money, isn't it? You start with...
By having money.
Yeah. You start with money and then you acquire more money. Do you know... what Lawrence Stroll's wife's name is not Mrs. Stroll. Dave, you look like you know.
I know it because I did the Googling. And do you think she is related to
I think I looked this up before and I could find no relationship to Raquel Diniz and Pedro Diniz.
Yeah, famously uncommon name, Diniz.
I'm going to ask ChatGPT.
I mean, ChatGPT will say yes.
The last time you did this, it was completely wrong about everything.
If it turns out Lawrence also owns Parmalat or something, then maybe there is a link. But
yeah.
Is Lance's middle name 40?
I think the Aston Martin question gets more interesting if we talk about the Max Verstappen to Mercedes rumours. Because who do you drop from Mercedes? Mm-hmm. Because either of them is the wrong decision. Kimi is...
But the right decision would be to drop Fernando Alonso from Aston Martin.
Yeah, there you go. So the rumour that I seen was Max to Mercedes and George Russell to Aston Martin. So who do you drop from Aston Martin?
Because Lance Stroll.
But really?
It would be great if there was a Aston Martin WEC programme.
But we're not going to put Fernando into that.
But you could put Lance Stroll into that, and then free up a seat.
You could put Lance Stroll into that. You absolutely could. Lance Stroll, however, has more points than Fernando Alonso this year.
Well, don't mind that. That's go away with your facts and your optics and all of that kind of stuff. It's Fernando Alonso. I think that's also Alonso is quite bored at the minute. I mean, when your teammate is Lance Stroll.
And you can't even beat him.
And you can't beat him. And just off the British Grand Prix, which one of them had a better race? Because Lance had a bloody good race, to be honest. The pass on Hülkenberg that he made was pretty great. Meanwhile, Fernando's 15th going, oh, how come you never get it right for me? I mean, which one of those two would you drop?
Lance Stroll.
I think Lance did very well while it was mixed grip conditions. So I think as soon as he got dry, he kind of fell back a bit. But through that kind of
it's an interesting actually with Stroll. So what I hadn't clocked is they put him on softs on like lap 7 around that VSC, and then he just burned them, made up loads of places. That's how he actually passed Hülkenberg. He was on really hot softs just as the track was at its driest. So completely surprised Hülkenberg, who was struggling around on worn inters. And then when everybody pitted to replace their worn inters, Lance pitted to put new inters on just as it started raining. Like he got the best out of those tyres. think the Alonso question is probably fair in that why didn't they make that strategy call with him? But he's the one who spends most of the race on the radio complaining at his team these days, because that's where Fernando's head's at again. Like, he's not that happy Fernando who was like crushing his teammate, getting podiums and all that stuff at the beginning of 23. He's just fallen back into old habits yet again, because that's who Fernando Alonso is. When he's great, he's great. When he's slightly off his game or the team's off his game, he's probably one of the worst people in the paddock to be around. And he won't galvanize a team around him in those situations. So if Max Verstappen does go to Mercedes, who do you have? Do you take George Russell, build Aston Martin Honda around him over Fernando Alonso? I think you probably would, right?
You do that. You probably drop Lance eventually and then bring
eventually,
in a rookie.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for now, I put George and Lance in that car and see what Lance is like with the new rule set. Because we've seen in the previous rule set, he actually got all right. And you go, all right, this is not terrible. And then it kind of went off the rails for the new rule set. But I wouldn't, this is going to sound really harsh, I wouldn't want to waste an Adrian Newey car on Fernando Alonso at this point.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I would.
Scott, I know you don't like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would absolutely give it to Alonso and Russell, because, like you said, when he's interested, he actually wants to be there and he's great. And I feel that if the car was good, he would want to be there. I think that, you know, when we talk about Lance versus Fernando, you know, it's very easy to look at the results and say, well, okay, Lance is much higher. You know, he's getting the results out of the car. He's doing much better. But you have to think about what's the driver's ceiling? Which driver has a higher ceiling that they can, not that they can reach all the time, but that they can get to? You know, I don't believe that Fernando can be world champion again, but he has proven that some years ago he was able to be a world champion. I don't see
years ago.
Yeah. Some years ago.
Decades ago.
2005 was only 6 years ago. Shut up. you know, but whereas I see Lance as scrape a win in a competitive car. You know, it's the same conversation that we had about Colapinto a couple of weeks ago. Colapinto versus Doohan. Which driver has the higher ceiling? And I, you know, yes, Colapinto is not doing himself any favor, but I think that he has a higher ceiling than Doohan.
So, say Newey gives them a car that's good and gets Alonso interested, but then you also got George Russell there in a car that's good enough to get Alonso interested.
Oh, that's going to be a toxic mess.
You imagine, and Russell starts and pushing Alonso, even beating him. Then you've got the Adrian Newey car with a grumpy Alonso in it.
Like, it's actually a waste, isn't it? I just love it when
it's
this happens.
It's 2007.
Yeah.
it's an interesting one. Like, you said, Scott, you don't think Fernando Alonso would be a world champion again. Does anyone think he'll win a race again?
Fernando Alonso does.
No. Yeah.
Fernando Alonso of 2025 and 2026. The guy that hasn't really shown that much for a year now.
I mean, if you talk to him, he's just done like his best ever race.
Oh yeah, but that's every race, no matter where he finishes every time, isn't it?
That's that kind of belief that's slightly misguided.
Which works really well as a world champion in your mid-20s. Now it's kind of borderline delusion, isn't it, really?
In an unknown lottery of 2026 race one, maybe like kind of that's his best opportunity. But as soon as things start to settle out, then unless, like, say, the engine's amazing, Newey's built this wonder car, and he's well ahead. I think there's got to be such a big delta over everyone else for Alonso to actually get several wins, if not one win. That is just such a big lottery.
Yeah, and not too long ago, we would have been, and did say, actually, the same thing about Lance Stroll. You need that big car delta for him to make good on Project Stroll World Champion. And now we're saying that about Fernando Alonso.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's inaccurate, but doesn't that just show how far Fernando Alonso's kind of fallen over the last year,
I think Fernando would be far more interesting if he went back over to IndyCar to become future Indy 500 winner and the Triple Crown winner. If I was him, I'd give that a go, because I think that is worth more than pootling around in F1. I think that's worth more than another F1 World Championship, to be honest. Getting an Indy 500 as well.
I think that if you're Fernando, what you do is you hang around in Formula One for another couple of years, because you recognize that all of the elements are there: decent engine, great designer, infinite budget. The ingredients are there for it to work. That does not mean it will work, but the ingredients are there. So I could imagine he hangs around until 2027, maybe finishes 2027, and then decides, right, screw this, let's go back over to America, you know, and actually enjoy racing for a while.
I think Alonso's eco works. If somebody just sat down with him and explained the Triple Crown and the opportunity and played to that ego part of it, surely that would convince him.
Speaking of things that don't work, can we talk about Alpine?
Well, can you be more specific?
I mean, in the first instance, I suppose, Pierre Gasly had one of those races that he has occasionally where he's quietly kind of brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
It just happens occasionally. It's like, it's like those outlier dots you get on a graph or statistical trend or whatever. It's like occasionally it's just a weird high point. You're like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. He was just like fifth or sixth all race for some reason in a car.
In the worst car.
Yeah, in a team that's kind of the worst team and the car that's the worst car.
I read a thing today that was the reason for Colapinto's retirement was it was stuck in second gear because he burnt the clutch out.
I read that one as well. Yeah. And that's not the first time he's done that.
Yeah. So what we're saying now is that he doesn't learn. Yeah, funny that. If only somebody on a podcast had predicted that.
I was actually going to pick up on the who has a higher ceiling thing with Colapinto and Doohan, because I genuinely think Doohan's quicker. He's rawer and a bit raggedy even compared to Colapinto. But in the races he had, I still think he showed something. I mean, it was wildly unfair for him to be dumped out of the team before he even had a chance to really put together a proper Grand Prix weekend. They put Colapinto in and he's done absolutely nothing. Like, he is literally pointless, figuratively as well, but quite literally. Yeah, I think he's ahead of Doohan in the championship just because it might have had a slightly better finish. But Doohan had, what, five races? That was it?
He's had six now, is he? Colapinto? It's five or six.
Something like that. But he's.
I suppose I'm arguing against myself, because it would be similarly harsh to dump Colapinto out after the same sort of number of races. But Colapinto had nine at the end of last year.
Yeah.
And has coasted on the perception of the first two, really, where he did actually look quite decent.
Well, it does seem that Alpine are considering that. You know, I know they're trying to get, or have they got Paul Aaron in a car to do a session?
Everybody's going to be in FP1s, that car.
Yeah.
Well, and Valtteri Bottas as well. They seem quite keen to.
Both of them are in that same car in Spa. Yeah.
There's no advantage to Bottas coming back and running that car at the back of the grid.
There's no disadvantage either.
Unless he does have a Cadillac drive for next year and he just needs to knock off some rust.
Then just go and test something rather than kill your own career by running around at the back in the worst car that you've not tested, that two people have already got punted out of. Because if he has two bad races, Flavio will sack him. Because Flavio's a magpie and somebody in F2 will have shown something.
Yeah, but Flavio also can't remember what he said.
What's
because at the time, when they got rid of Doohan and they put out the announcement, I'll come back to that in a minute, but the quote was very much, we're going to give Colapinto the next six races or until the summer break, whatever it was. It was quite specific in its timeline. And Flavio is, oh no, I never said that. So, well, it literally says in the Alpine press release, Flavio Briatore, Belen director of Chaos, said this. So either he didn't say it and they made it up and that's a problem, or he did say it and he can't remember and that's a problem.
Alpine do have a form of putting out press releases of stuff that's not true. Just ask Oscar Piastri.
Yeah. Flavio Briatore is not far off making a tweet saying, I understand without my consent or whatever. Alpine have put out a statement.
Yeah. Is there not
saying that Alpine have put out a statement? Yeah.
Is there not a maximum number of drivers you're allowed in a car in 1 year? And is it not three?
Yeah, it's three, yeah.
So whoever goes into this car is either into the end of the year or Jack Doohan's returning.
No, it's fine. Just put Gasly in the other car. And then you can put three more into Gasly's car.
That's how it works, right? That's how it worked. I don't love if the rules are written in a way that you can do that. Flavio's phoning up a good Suzuki or something going, have you got on there? Do you come with Honda engines?
Have you got any old Arrows chassis? Yeah, does that help me somehow? Yeah. How many cobwebs are at Lee Field?
Yeah. I have a question for you guys about Nico Hülkenberg. Obviously, we are all absolutely thrilled to see him get the podium. For me, that's pretty much the story of the race. Nico Hülkenberg gets the podium, yeah?
The race?
Well,
the season, decade, millennium. Well,
here's a possibly daft question. Do you think that Lewis Hamilton also recognized this and gave Hulk the podium?
No.
No.
Lewis Hamilton did not give up a British Grand Prix podium for that. That's as ridiculous as asking Lando Norris to give up a British Grand Prix win because you made an arse of yourself.
So it was in the back of my mind towards the end where it was obvious Lewis wasn't going to get it. Is that, did he maybe? No, because Lewis Hamilton and a Ferrari competing for a podium at Silverstone is like, that's the rag to the bull, isn't it? I'm not going to make the prancing horse pun, even though I kind of just did.
I mean,
I think it is that a little mistake bit that Lewis theory. Made, it probably would have been a lot closer, especially on the outlap. But Hülkenberg just had him covered, really, because it was Rise of the Goat.
And the return of Nick. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
I put in the vote that I'd rather a Hamilton podium than a Hulk podium. I'm not going to hide her away from that. And
why?
So at the time, it did seem to me more like that Lewis was going to take him. So I think I was just kind of betting on that. But as
so
it kind of
glory hunting.
Hey Siri, how do I kick people out of a podcast?
The Aston Villa supporter hunting glory.
Exactly. But that doesn't take away from my joy of the Hülkenberg podium. I wasn't sitting there going, "Oh, I should have been Lewis." But I would say that if Ferrari had put Lewis on mediums rather than softs, I do think it would have been quite different as well.
I mean, given the conditions, you would assume that softs are probably the right tyres to go for. Cold conditions, they're going to fire up sooner.
Yeah, but you're only getting like 5-6 laps out. I think they went before off. They were dead. Yeah. Like they went off a cliff, Pirelli style.
But they were also a lap or two early, Ferrari.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as we've seen, I think we've seen a load of times over the years at Silverstone when it has rained, nobody ever seems to quite consider just how bad that outlap is, but specifically just how bad leaving the pits is up a really greasy hill offline into quite a tricky right-hander. Loads of people go off time and again. And Lewis lost like 8 seconds through that phase relative to Hülkenberg. Was what, one lap later, I think, not even two, but knew what he had to do, which was just not push at the exit and into turn three. He kept it on the road and then he banked the time, and that was it. Then it was just measured performance.
Not only do they seem to underestimate that every time it rains at Silverstone, it wasn't even the first time in this race that they all committed the same thing, because they all pitted 1 to 2 laps too early, earlier on, because Fernando was on the slicks and finally got a good lap in, but it took him three laps to get the tyres up to temperature, by which time he'd lost an entire pit stop anyway.
And then lose the 10 seconds on the outlap and the same old stuff.
the entire grid went, okay, now it's time. It's like, it's very clearly wasn't time.
It's like George Sector Russell 3 is now 1/10 faster on slicks than on wets, right? It's time to pit. Wait, it's raining. Did we forget to look up again?
George Russell made a ridiculous comment because he moved onto the slicks and then spun and said, oh, it's a bit wetter than before. It's like, it hasn't rained since then, George.
It's like there's more water on the surface of the track under your tyres.
Yeah.
But it's because they are slick and it's not getting rid of any water. It's a different thing, George.
It was very much the F1 teams are looking at data rather than the screens and using their own eyes and looking at what's going on.
Stick your hand out the back of the garage, that whole thing.
Exactly.
It's just amazing that literally everybody did it. So not one person thought, let's do something different. Let's just stay on the internet and see what happens. Like if you're already 11th or 12th or whatever, something, like everybody just did the same thing. It was so, just bizarre. Yeah.
I think there was one good tyre call in that race, and it was Aston Martin to put Stroll on the softs early doors because they did it at the right time. They didn't do it at the beginning of the race like Leclerc and Russell. That gamble didn't seem to make a lot of sense, but, you know, track dries, whatever, maybe it works out. But it wasn't the right tyre for the conditions that were at play, and that's generally the thing you want to be doing. Just be on the right tyres for the conditions that you have on the racetrack and listen to your drivers as well, which is something Sauber did with the one true goat, Nico Hülkenberg. Like at least three times they were like, we want a pit, we want a pit. And Hulk's like, I'm going to stay out. Thanks, guys. It's a bit slippy. He's like, what about slicks? It's raining. I will stick on my intermediates. Thank you very much, sir. And I will see you next lap, maybe.
Unfortunately, Mercedes did listen to their driver, George Russell, who was categorically wrong in his call.
Yeah, but he was really confident with the decision, though. That makes you listen.
It's proof that if you speak with confidence, people will listen. Even Toto Wolff, whilst he's rocking a really terrible flat cap with Mercedes branding on it and everything, he listened to his driver, and credit to him for that. Driver was really wrong, but, you know, well done.
I think we're a good example of that
movie
as well.
Or something.
Was the British Grand Prix better than F1 the movie?
I mean, I didn't want to walk out of the cinema during the British Grand Prix, so let's say yes. It was a better story. It was a better climax to it.
Was it a more convincing story, or was it equally as daft? Hülkenberg gets podium.
I mean, I've seen it coming for years, so I'd say it's quite predictable, really.
I think you're possibly the only one. Even Nico Hülkenberg didn't see it coming.
No, it was better sport, and it was a better story. It was acted quite a bit better, really. I think the dialogue wasn't as stilted. So, the Grand Prix was quite a bit better than the film, really.
I don't know. McLaren's dialogue after the race was pretty stilted. You see Zach Brown trying to mediate after the race and try and get Oscar into some team photos and force a smile out of him. That was pretty good acting there.
Yeah, so I suppose on that Piastri thing, I mean, at the time, I was very much like, that's a slam dunk, 10-second penalty, because he's slowed up unnecessarily, and he did drop speed by 100 miles an hour. The brake pressure was double what George did in that little bit of gamesmanship with Verstappen at Canada. I think it adds up to a penalty still. But I did watch the Julian Palmer video on it earlier, and we very rarely disagree, me and Julian, except on like pace around Bedford. That's a different matter. But he was like, it's really, really harsh. And I can kind of see it from that side a little bit, but it's a wet race. He slowed kind of significantly. I think Max played it up a bit because he sort of got about half on the brake and just sort of let it coast past. So he didn't lock up, but still he made more of a meal of it than he could have done. I think to prove a point more than anything, which, you know, fair play. Play silly games, win silly prizes a little bit. Was it really a 10-second penalty? Like, have we seen one of those before?
That's the same penalty for Max pushing George off back in Spain. Yeah.
Pushing George. Yeah.
Right, so this is the issue. It's a, there is a penalty that's wrong here, and it's Max's one.
Yeah.
You cannot use that.
If we're going on the scale of that's a 10-second penalty, then, well,
I think they're both wrong penalties, and we went over this in the Spanish Grand Prix podcast, where, you know, I was of the opinion that it should be a disqualification. With this one, I felt that 10 seconds was a bit harsh. I could understand a 5-second penalty, but I just felt that 10 seconds was a little bit much. But this is also the weekend when, you know, the stewards weren't taking any nonsense from anybody. They gave Ollie Bearman 4 penalty points for crashing under the red flag.
For going flat out into a pit lane and then crashing under a red flag. I don't think that was excessive, that one.
No, that's fine.
Does anybody know when the last time a driver was awarded 4 penalty points for one incident?
When was
the last time someone did something that stupid? I don't know.
Grosjean.
Kevin Magnussen.
Well,
like,
Verstappen in Spain when he hit Russell, but still. But the thing with Piastri was he did the same thing on the first safety car restart, and it actually sent Hülkenberg onto the grass from like fifth or sixth at the time. That concertinaed really quite badly, and we've seen in Mugello, 2020, just how bad that can be in dry conditions, let alone the wet. I think it's one of those sort of rare cases where, kind of correctly, it wasn't penalizing the consequence so much as it was penalizing the action.
Yeah.
Which I think is correct. I think you could argue 5 seconds or 10 seconds based on what did actually happen, but it was boneheaded, really, given the conditions and the safety of everyone involved.
I felt his excuse was really weird because he said he did it the lap before and the safety car before. I was like, well, that's not a great defense.
He did it the safety car before, and it basically skittled people onto the grass. They didn't make contact with each other, but it spread the field pretty badly. It just wasn't actually shown on TV at the time, I don't think.
But if you,
so I was quite confused when I saw that in the highlights. Hülkenberg spearing off to driver's right on Harris Strait.
Right,
we didn't see that. And on the one he got penalised for, the restart he got penalised for, Hülkenberg was just in the middle of the road, wasn't really caught out by it at all. Like, those were two separate restarts, or separate incidents at least.
But if you get convicted of a crime, it's not a great defence to be like, well, I did it last week as well.
Yeah. So what do you mean you're doing me for tax evasion? I committed so much of that last year.
Exactly. Wait. So that's point one. And point two was his excuse was the safety car lights went off, so he had to react quickly, which I don't buy at all, because if the safety, yes, it was quite a late call to bring in the safety car, but you didn't have to immediately lose 100 mile an hour then and there. You could have done that over the course, triple the distance. And it would have
the hangar straight's not small, is it? Like,
well, I guess he just wanted to get the heat into the tires. That's really what he was doing.
But then you don't need to just go, oh God, the safety car lights just went out, jam on the brakes.
Yeah, because when the safety car lights have gone out, you as the leader of the race become the safety car. That's the line, isn't it?
You're meant
you are
to maintain
responsible
pace.
For controlling the pace. Yeah, you've got to build a gap, admittedly. So there's a line in there somewhere.
I'm okay with the penalty. It is on the harsh side. 10 seconds is on the harsh side. But it's kind of, if you were to set boundaries of harsh and lenient, it's within the boundaries, I think.
Yeah. It's a little bit play fine. Stupid games, win stupid prizes, isn't it, really?
It is a bit.
And Piastri's, I think you said a little bit, Dave, in the chat, it's like, there's a few chinks in his armour now, Piastri. We're seeing a couple cracks here and there. And we've seen Lando go the other way. With whatever he's doing, is it just a theory that he's talking to a sports psychologist or someone, or has that been said? But he's turned something around. Like, his head's in a totally different place now, and Piastri's is now in a completely different place as well.
I think Piastri
in just
has
the very opposite way.
You know, I think each driver is having a run, a good run and a bad run, and I think it does kind of. You know, I think that Piastri is having a not great run, whereas he had a better run at the start of the year. But likewise, Lando had a great run and then had a slightly poorer run. And I think that that's the way that this championship is going to run right until the end of the year. I think it's going to go between the two of them right up until the last race.
So is it just the ebb and flow of a 23-24 race season?
Yeah, with two drivers who drive an identical car.
But I think the difference here is that Oscar was seen as unbreakable, whereas Lando was seen as fragile. I don't think that's harsh on either of them to put it that way. Lando has always talked about mental health and struggles with it. And, you know, credit to him for doing that. That's a difficult thing to talk about. But he's always been seen as a little bit more fragile, whereas Oscar's just been treated as nothing breaks him at all.
And so now much it's a robot, there's no personality, that
well,
kind of
Oscar,
thing.
Yeah. You know, if you put yourself in Oscar's shoes, he had a 15-second lead that got wiped out by a safety car, and then he had a 10-second penalty. You know, there's a 25-second advantage, you know, that was basically taken away with him. I think he's right to be annoyed about it. I think that's totally fair. I don't see that as a chink in his armor. You know, I know he said, let's invert the positions. Come on, that's not going to happen. Let's be realistic, Oscar. We're not going to do that. But at the same time, you know, if he displayed no emotion at all and just said, I accept the penalty. You know,
it would be really strange if he wasn't disappointed.
That would be even weirder. You know, this was an easy Oscar win.
I disagree with that.
I know you do, and I knew you would as well.
But it wasn't an easy Oscar win. So he had a gap at a time when Lando was managing the gap, and as soon as it became time for pit stops, Lando pulled up to within a couple of seconds of him. That gap went back out after the first safety car, and Lando brought it straight back in again.
And so what's to say that Oscar wasn't managing that gap as well?
Because Oscar had the gap 10 seconds. He had a penalty and he was unable to pull the gap.
But he did at that point. Yeah, when he didn't have track position, he was driving angry because he'd lost 25 seconds.
No, he did have track position. He was leading and Oscar caught him before the 10-second penalty.
Sorry, I meant Oscar.
Pit stop.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so Oscar was leading. Lando caught up. They switched positions in the 10 seconds, and then Lando pulled away. The only time that Oscar was faster was at the start of the stint, at the very start of the race. Yes, that got wiped out by a safety car, but you could also say it's like, well, he wasn't fastest when it mattered. If he was able to pull a 15-second gap, he probably should have done it when he had a 10-second penalty, and he couldn't do it because Lando was on it. This is what I meant earlier in the season.
I don't agree.
This is what I meant earlier in the season, where I actually think Lando's ceiling is higher than Oscar's, but Oscar will hit his ceiling consistently, whereas Lando certainly was not. And I think we've seen that in Austria, where Oscar was overconfident and thought, I can beat Lando. And it turns out when he had the DRS, he couldn't even keep up with Lando, never mind actually beat him. And then we've seen it again at Silverstone. As soon as it became, right, you need to get the 10-second gap, Lando closed the gap. Got him in the pit stop and then drove away. That's pretty, I'm going to say hard. That's got to feel pretty bad for Oscar, because you're like, oh,
well,
I couldn't do what I needed to do.
Well, I think if you just add 25 seconds onto everybody else's time, or take 25 seconds off Oscar's time, it was an easy win. You know, he pulled away when it mattered. He was he had Max between him and Lando. You know, Max wasn't exactly going to move over. Well, he did this time last year at the British Grand Prix for Lando coming in Stowe. But, you know, I can see that Lando would probably, and we're getting into ifs and buts here, Lando would probably have got past Max after a couple of laps. Meanwhile, Piastri extends his advantage. It's an easy win. But
if it was going to be an easy win, why didn't he get the 10-second gap if he had done it before?
I don't know.
He could have still won it then. I can tell you why. Because he wasn't fast enough. When it came to crunch time, Lando somehow did not succumb to pressure and just got his head down, closed the gap, and then drove away after the position swap.
And in trying to chase Lando down, Piastri did have quite a meaty off.
He certainly did. You know. Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was driving angry at that point, understandably so. You know.
Yeah, but if you switch these around, if you switch those drivers around, the internet perception becomes Lando bottled it.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
We're talking about, Oscar got an easy win stolen. It's like, did he? Or did he
He did. No, he didn't bottle it. He got 25 seconds wiped off his advantage. No, he didn't bottle it. No. I don't believe that internet perception of Lando bottling it exists anymore. You know, it doesn't, you know. And for me, Austria really proved that, you know. But I don't believe either of them bottled it, you know.
The perception doesn't exist because he went and won like four races or something and outperformed his teammate.
But for me, Austria was like really, really proved it, you know. Yeah, he's had some brilliant races. I think that Lando's game has taken a considerable step up this year, but I believe Oscar's game has also taken a considerable step up this year. And I think that they're both really, really evenly matched. I would agree with your assessment that Lando's ceiling is higher, but that Oscar reaches his more often. I think that's exactly what's happening. And these are the ingredients that make for an absolutely brilliant season. Like, this is just great because you've got two drivers who have two quite different styles of how they go through a weekend and how they win and how they progress. And the fact that they're both in the same team, this is just brilliant racing.
See, I don't think Oscar bottled it, but I don't think he was fast enough. I mean, it just falls in the middle. And Lando was just simply faster, and I think Lando would have had it without the penalty. But what I think about is Oscar's reaction post race, especially in the whole throwing a strop and saying you can't brake behind the safety car anymore and things like that, which is good because it's showing that emotion and things like that. But it doesn't show to me that he bottled it. I don't know if he thought he was, I don't know, doing a Max or something like that, or kind of playing at that level. And I do wonder if the reaction was exacerbated by the fact it nearly impacted Max, and it's Max that's close to a driving ban. And if it had been Lewis Hamilton behind him or Charles Leclerc or something, it'd have been less of a reaction. I don't know, but I was really disappointed in Oscar at the end because I've quite enjoyed him the past five or six races, and I quite admired, it's almost a Kimi Raikkonen-esque kind of coldness. But to see him throwing a strop like that after the race, I think kind of let himself down quite a lot.
Don't agree. Total disagree there. I think that he is entirely right to be annoyed at a penalty that was overly harsh and to lose the advantage during the safety car. I think that, and especially, you know, that was a mentally tough race for every single driver out there, you know. So he's not going to come out of the car at the end of the race and have this perfectly nuanced statement. They're all exhausted after that race. That wasn't a dry race, lights to flag, let's go. Like, there was a lot of thinking for every single driver. I mean, if I was Oscar, I would have been in exactly the same position. I would have been incredibly annoyed at this, you know. And I know he has that reputation of being Iceman, no emotions, nothing fazes him. It's not true. Like, he's still human at the end of the day, you know. But I wasn't disappointed whenever I saw him, you know. I wouldn't even say it was a strop. I would say he was very annoyed, and he made his emotions quite clear to everybody. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Well, I enjoyed Hülkenberg's reaction to it in the cooldown room when Piastri was like almost the pleading for witnesses type thing. I got a penalty for that, and Hulk was like, "Well, I was on the grass avoiding it." So it was kind of like, well.
That's what I mean. Like, I think he just refused to see what he did wrong.
But that's Formula One driver. Yeah. All Formula One drivers are like that. They, you know, we were talking about Fernando Alonso, you know, refusing to admit that he is now 75 years old. You know, it's the same for all of them. You know, it's very rare that they will admit fault in a marginal incident. If the incident is 100% your fault, chances are they will admit it. You know, and again, we talk about Lando in Canada. That's, you know, he owned it up like before the car had even come to a stop. You know, and fair play to him for doing so. But I think that, you know, like for a marginal incident, they're always going to blame the other guy every single time. And for one that where you feel that you've taken stuff away. Well,
you blame the other guy.
You blame the stewards. Involved. Yeah, but you blame the stewards. You know, you blame the system. It's lashing out at a system that you feel is unfair because you've been what you feel is unfairly penalized. And what some people also feel is unfairly penalized as well. You know, on the commentary, they, you know, Palmer and DC both said that is very harsh. Now, obviously, they didn't have the specifics of the incident at the time in the way that the stewards did and the telemetry showed it, you know. You know, Nick, what was Palmer's, like, what was his conclusion on that? Because I haven't seen the video yet.
It was just that he felt it was harsh and couldn't really remember a time when there'd been another penalty like it for that kind of deceleration, I suppose, behind a safety car. It does seem like an outlier. It did seem like an unusual penalty, but it also at the time did seem penalty worthy. Whether that was reactionary or not,
do you think if there'd been no reaction, cars,
you have your judgment.
Do you think if there had been any, like if there'd been no cars behind him, that the penalty would be applied?
That's kind of a weird question.
Reasonable to do that.
That situation can't exist.
Well, if he's running at the back of the field,
yeah, you can do what you want at the back of the field. You're not meant to be controlling the pace of the field behind you.
But let's say. Hypothetically, the car behind is quite far behind, like really far behind, and you do this.
They can only be like 10 car lengths behind, right? Otherwise, they get a penalty.
But they kind of play with that as well. So,
you know, it'd be really interesting to hear it. So it's like we get this comparison to George Russell in Montreal quite a lot. We're not comparing it to any other time. It'd be interesting to have like a graph or some sort of plot of this is the kind of brake pressure that other people have done over the time. This is the speed loss over time, things like that. So all we've got is George Russell's one for some reason, which was never a penalty. It was just Red Bull decided it was going to be a penalty.
George himself was basically inside the safety car, so had to back off anyway.
Yeah, it's maybe not the best example to use. It's just the one that we're using for some reason. Yeah.
No, it's the most obvious one because it happened like two races ago.
Yeah.
And it was for a win. And it was stupid then.
I suppose the interesting thing is what the penalty was for, because it was just for a safety car infringement. It's nothing specific. It wasn't for overslowing or braking or reckless driving or anything like that. It was just an infringement of procedure, which is a woolly one. It's what you use when you kind of don't have anything stronger to penalize against. Yeah. It's not like speeding in the pit lane or, you know, going fast in the Delta or whatever. It's like, I don't know, don't like it. Right, what can we do? 10 seconds. Cool.
Safety car infringement, that'll do.
I think it was something, but, you know, it's happened.
Can I possibly share my unpopular opinion about this weekend?
All of your opinions are unpopular, but go for it.
Would you have rather have had a week off?
No, I very much enjoyed the British Grand Prix. Silverstone, the first sector is stupid and the pit lane is in the wrong place.
That's not an unpopular
opinion? I thought you were leading into something with some facts.
I thought that was an unpopular opinion because anytime you put on the commentary, like, this is the world's best circuit and it's the history of all the circuits, blah, 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 blah. No other circuit comes anywhere close to this.
Pit lane's in the wrong place. The pit building's at the wrong angle and it leaks. Like, what do you want? It's a bit of a shithole, really, Silverstone, but we love it despite that, you know.
Yeah, the old one leaks as well, so it's fine. It's just on brand.
The old one leaked when I was in it 20 years ago and the power went out, and it still does it now. So,
yeah.
That's history.
If you want an unpopular opinion, if you brought the old circuit back, Bridge would be on an uneventful corner now because it was getting easy flat in the 90s with groove tires. Can you imagine what the current cars are doing? We would be sorely disappointed if they
Surely
Brooklands is a better corner for being off a long straight.
It is.
100% agree.
But surely now Bridge would just be like almost like a braking zone into whatever that corner was. Priory, that's what it was. Yeah, yeah.
That was tricky.
Yeah, yeah. That was a tricky one, you know. And we will never forget Silverstone 1995.
I think the current Abbey first corner is better than the old Abbey chicane was because that wasn't a particularly great chicane. It was kind of a stop gap because you couldn't run flat into Bridge.
Totally agree.
Bridge would now be uneventful, sadly. But
the Abbey chicane had very interesting curbs, though, if you're a curb nerd.
It did. It had a very interesting sort of blocky, bricky as well.
Weirdness. Yeah.
But that current, like turn two, turn three, turn four, it looks stupid because it's all tarmac and tarmac runoff, so you don't know where the track is. It's just been deliberately designed to be complicated. It doesn't flow. It's just stupid.
But it's just
technical. It's technical is what it is, which is actually deeply satisfying when you get it right and you figure out the tricks. If you just drive it like a natural racing track, you know, try and just find your line through it, you get it wrong and it'll be frustrating. It's like the first sector at the Nürburgring GP circuit, actually, since they, I was going to say new. It's not new at all. It's like 25 years old.
It's new for us because we're old.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like that. That's a horrible Mickey Mouse thing until you figure it out. And then it's like, oh, I get it now. And then you're 2 seconds of that faster for it than anyone else and you feel even better.
Also, it produces good racing. Like, it's awful as those corners are to watch and as awful as they are to drive in simulators. It produces good racing and people are able to do weird lunges into the tight left hand. That
dramatic switchback effectively. You can do the block pass, a Max Verstappen block pass, actually, but without forcing the other driver wide and at a much lower, less dangerous speed. Max's kind of typical.
Corner onto Wellington is really satisfying, the fast left-hander. That's a really nice corner. Cars often come out side by side. So
there's a bit of jeopardy in that one. Yeah.
Especially when it's wet.
Main thing that annoys me about Silverstone is Silverstone knows it's great.
Yeah, I totally understand. I know exactly what you mean. They want everybody to know we are the home of all racing ever.
No, the worst thing about Silverstone is not the race circuit itself. It's the infrastructure around it, how everything is difficult to get. Everything's a million miles away. And when you get there, the quality is appalling compared to
and
what
it has
see
that
elsewhere.
British sense of we're the best, it's great. Yeah. So well, part of it's really good. But that doesn't give you a free pass for the rest of it being a bit ropey.
Yeah.
Which is Bernie Ecclestone's point all along, really. And I don't particularly like agreeing with Bernie a lot of the time, but it makes sense now and again.
I've never been there for the F1.
Oh, I wouldn't want to, I don't think.
But I've been there for like several WEC races and ALMS and things. And what I always remember is it's designed so weirdly that if you're not next to the track, you can't see it. You have to be kind of in a grandstand to see the track. There's no kind of casual observation as you're walking around. And that must be really frustrating for an event like F1.
And there's still some weird dead ends you can find yourself in just by walking along the track. All of a sudden there's a fence in the way or the track's in the way of the track somehow. And you're like, well, what do I do now? Walk 3 miles the other direction, apparently.
Yeah.
We've been to a lot of racetracks over the last 18 months or so. And
several of them were Silverstone as well, aren't you?
Yeah, but Silverstone is consistently a weird experience because you do end up in these weird spectator dead zones and you're just like, how did I get here? And also, how do I get out? And I can see a bit of track over there. How do I get there? Yeah. Like, there's like one bridge or something.
Yeah, there's a British GT Media Day, I think. I was just walking along the inside of the track. I think it was before I met up with you, Dave. Inside of the track on the entry to Maggots and Beckett's. So, you know, you think you walk out of the paddock and just along the side of the track, there's a grandstand there, which is sort of closed off and whatever. Well, you know, there's plenty of room between the fence, the track side and the fence and this grandstand. I just walk down there. Can see you know, your future ahead of you mapped out. Basically, I want to walk over there and keep walking and I'll be following alongside the track. It's just a fence in the way, connecting the fence at the side of the track to the grandstand. You can't get through it. It's a permanent fence. You're like, well, why? Now I've got to walk back, walk around the grandstand to just be 1 centimeter in front of myself. It's like none of it makes sense. And the whole like Esplanade thing's like crazy and like, I don't know what they're doing there most of the time, but it's a great racetrack and it's still fun to go there. But it is just, it's so British in its execution, really. Like, pull one thread, the entire Mirage falls apart. You know?
If anybody who is listening was at the British Grand Prix or thinks that Silverstone is a brilliant track, please do let us know. We would like to hear from you. We will take your contrary opinion on board. Might disregard it as well. Who knows? But we'll definitely read it out anyway.
I mean, at 40 quid for an umbrella, a few people are kind of unimpressed at the weekend, especially if they're getting wet. But, you know.
We were saddened this week to learn about the passing of our good friend, Greg Alexander. Greg's work in Formula One was something that you've probably come across as a listener. Anybody who has ever watched a YouTube clip and sees the URL, f1archives.com, that was Greg. He set up F1 Archives quite a while ago before he got told to take it down. And then was very annoyed at Top Gear for using one of the F1 Archives clips. And I don't believe that they got it taken down. Greg was a really great guy. And his YouTube channel, Greg's VR, the tagline was P1 Passion, P10 Talent. And that was Greg all over. He wasn't afraid to admit that he wasn't the best driver in the world, but his knowledge, his passion, and his love for especially early 90s Formula One, it's a bit of an inspiration to all of us, and he would have absolutely loved the British Grand Prix as well. So at this time, we're remembering Greg and his family.